start today. Stop overthinking, start doing. Written by Justice O. Malcolm. Published by Audiobooks Office. Introduction. I didn't plan to write this book. I planned to get around to writing it. There's a difference, and for most of my life that difference ruled me. I used to carry ideas the way some people carry stones in their pockets. Weighty, distracting, oddly comforting in their familiarity. Every year I'd add another, promising myself that one day I'd finally set them down and build something with them. But days blurred into seasons, and seasons into years, and I kept waiting for some perfect convergence of clarity, bravery, time, or maybe divine intervention. Whatever it was, it never arrived. What arrived instead were more stones, more ideas, more hesitation disguised as preparation. And if I'm honest, I grew good at dressing my avoidance in respectable clothes. I could make hesitation look like thoughtfulness, disguise doubt as realism, and call delay a form of care. It all sounded so reasonable that even I believed it. But there comes a moment when the weight becomes impossible to ignore. Mine showed up on a winter morning that didn't look special in any way. I remember standing at my kitchen counter, hands wrapped around a mug that had long since cooled, staring at the list of projects I swore I'd start, stories I wanted to write, habits I wanted to reclaim, conversations I needed to have, changes I kept postponing. I felt the familiar tightening in my chest, that subtle contraction that comes from knowing you're not living in alignment with the life you keep imagining. The list wasn't long, but it felt endless, the kind of endless that turns a person quiet. I wouldn't call it an epiphany. Epiphanies are glamorous and clean. This was more like a quiet tipping point, the soft recognition that I couldn't bear another year of promising myself beginnings that I never touched. Something had to shift, and I realized that if the shift wasn't going to come from inspiration, it had to come from motion. Imperfect, unplanned, unglamorous motion. So I picked one thing. Writing this book wasn't the thing I picked that day, but it grew from the one I did. I chose something small, a task so humble it would have been embarrassing to name it as a goal. But that didn't matter. What mattered was that my body moved before my mind had a chance to negotiate me back into stillness. There was no revelation afterward, no triumphant soundtrack, just a strange and quiet steadiness. For the first time in a long while, I felt like someone who could do things rather than someone who endlessly rehearsed the idea of doing them. Action, I discovered, isn't loud. It isn't dramatic or heroic. It's not the cinematic surge of adrenaline we're taught to expect. It's quiet, almost modest. Often it's clumsy, but it's real. It's the place where ideas stop being theories about who we might become and start being the raw materials of who we are actively shaping ourselves into. The trouble is that most of us have been trained to believe that we must feel ready before we begin, and readiness, at least the kind we imagine, rarely shows up on its own. What does show up is hesitation, that internal fog that whispers, not yet, not today, not until you're certain, not until you know. You think hesitation keeps you safe, but really it just keeps you paused. I've spent years watching people, including myself, get tangled in that pause. Some of the gentlest, most brilliant souls I know are caught in it right now. They hesitate not because they lack intelligence or drive, but because they care deeply. They want to do things well. They want to make their efforts meaningful. They want to avoid regret, embarrassment, wasted time, disappointment. But in trying to avoid the pain of doing something imperfectly, they end up living with the slow, accumulating ache of not doing it at all. This book is not about productivity or discipline or efficiency. I'm not here to teach you how to optimize your hours or architect the perfect routine. I don't believe action is something that needs to be systematized. I believe it needs to be reclaimed. It needs to be felt again as something intimate, soulful, deeply human. Action is the moment we re-enter our lives. It's the moment our stories stop being imagined futures and start being lived truths. It's less about accomplishment and more about aliveness, showing up, participating, taking responsibility for the shape of our days. I wrote this book as a companion for anyone who feels stuck in their own hesitation. Not a coach shouting instructions from the sidelines, and not an expert pretending to have transcended the very struggles I'm writing about. I'm a fellow traveler, someone who knows how heavy those pocket stones can get, someone who has learned, slowly, stubbornly, that motion can be a form of mercy. If you're holding this book, I'll assume something in your life is asking you to move again. Not in a dramatic way. Not in the reinvent everything way that fills headlines and empty promises. Maybe your life is whispering instead of shouting. Maybe a part of you is tired of waiting for the perfect moment, tired of circling the same decisions, tired of knowing what you want but not stepping toward it. If so, I'm here with you, not to push you, not to fix you, but to walk with you as you relearn what it means to start today. In the middle of the mess, in the presence of doubt, with whatever courage you can carry. This book is my hand on the door, gently turning the knob, letting some light in. The rest is up to you. And that's the beautiful part. You're already more capable than you think. You're already closer than you know. And the only thing missing, the thing that has always been missing, is the motion that begins the story. To read the complete book, visit our website and get the complete ebook, now available on the website at audiobooksoffice.com. Welcome, let's step inside. Chapter 1. The moment you finally move. Sometimes the moment you finally move doesn't look like a moment at all. It's rarely cinematic, rarely loud, rarely the kind of instant you could point to in hindsight and say, "There, that was it." More often, it's a quiet turning, a subtle tilt in the atmosphere of your life. It arrives disguised as exhaustion or restlessness or a thin thread of honesty that finally refuses to snap. It sneaks up on you in the same room where you've been sitting for months or years, in the same life you've been rehearsing but not quite inhabiting, and even when it begins, you don't immediately realize it's begun. You think you're just shifting in your chair, or reaching for the light switch, or taking a step you've talked yourself out of 100 times. Only later, sometimes much later, do you recognize it as the moment that changed everything. I've come to believe that these beginnings never arrive when we're ready. They arrive when we're tired of not being ready. There's a difference. People romanticize readiness as though it's a peak state we must climb to before we can start anything meaningful. But readiness, in my experience, is a feeling that shows up after you move, not before. The moments I have waited for, the courage, the clarity, the sense of arrival, were almost always byproducts of motion, and for years I waited anyway. I waited for the fear to shrink, for the uncertainties to settle, for the self-doubt to quiet itself. But hesitation has a way of strengthening when you feed it time. It grows roots. It spreads into corners you didn't think it could reach. Before long, even the smallest decisions feel like heavy doors. There was a stretch of my life when I felt like I was living on the wrong side of those doors. I kept imagining another version of myself, someone braver, more assured, someone already in motion. And I lived in a kind of internal exile from that version. It wasn't that my life was terrible. It was fine. Fine enough that no alarm bells were ringing. Fine enough that I could rationalize my inaction. But fine has a quiet trap hidden inside it. You don't realize you're suffocating until your lungs start craving a deeper breath than fine allows. The truth is, I didn't change because I suddenly understood something new. I changed because I couldn't stand the cost of staying the same. And that cost wasn't dramatic. It didn't explode my life. It eroded it. It chipped away at the feeling that my days belonged to me. It dulled the edges of my own curiosity. It made me an observer of my wants rather than a participant in them. You can live that way for a long time. Many people do, but living that way eventually makes you feel like a ghost inside your own story. My moment of movement came on a morning that could have been any other. I woke up feeling the familiar weight of everything I hadn't done. It wasn't guilt exactly, it was a different kind of pressure, something quieter and sadder. A sense that I was beginning to forget what it felt like to follow through on a promise to myself. Promises to others I could keep easily, but the ones meant for me? Those were the ones I kept postponing. I told myself I needed more time, more clarity, more confidence, but the truth was simpler. I was afraid that beginning would reveal that I wasn't capable of becoming who I hoped I could be. That morning something shifted, not dramatically, not even noticeably, a small truth rose to the surface. My life was not going to change unless I did, and the only way I knew to change was to move. So I picked something simple, a task so small it almost felt insulting to name it as progress. I told myself, just do this one thing. Not all the things, not the entire mountain, just this pebble. And for reasons I still don't fully understand, I did it. That tiny action didn't fix my life. It didn't solve all the problems or answer all the questions. What it did was break the spell. And that might be the most powerful thing a small action can do. It interrupts the trance of stuckness. It introduces motion where there was none. It whispers to your fearful mind, see, you can move, you are not trapped here, you are not immovable. That whisper is often the beginning of everything. When I talk to people who feel stuck, they often describe their lives the way someone might describe an overgrown forest, too dense, too tangled, too much. They think the solution requires a dramatic machete swing, a sweeping, decisive clearing. But the truth is, most paths through the forest begin with one careful step. Not the step that solves everything, just the step that proves movement is possible. Once you've taken that, the next becomes easier to imagine, and then one day you're walking, and then one day you're not lost anymore. Better to think of it as a journey, as an eternal journey. The final destination comes to many, but there's honesty required in that first step. It isn't noble. It isn't graceful. It's awkward. It's vulnerable. It's usually accompanied by the feeling that you are unprepared, unqualified, and one wrong move away from making a fool of yourself. That's okay. Awkward beginnings are still beginnings. Vulnerable movement is still movement. Courage doesn't arrive as confidence. It arrives as willingness. Willingness to try, even when your inner critic is whispering that you shouldn't. Willingness to move, even when you fear the movement won't take you far. Sometimes willingness is the only fuel you have, and sometimes it's enough. The moment you finally move is rarely about the thing you do. It's about what that thing interrupts. It interrupts the story you've been telling yourself about how change is impossible, or unlikely, or reserved for people stronger than you. It interrupts the belief that you must wait for permission. It interrupts the internal negotiation that has kept your desire and your action on opposite sides of the same door. When you move, the argument falls apart. You become the kind of person who does rather than the kind who merely intends. And once you feel that, once you feel the shift from intention to action, it becomes very difficult to forget. Something in you wakes up. You sense the quiet truth that your life is not something happening to you, it's something responding to you. What you choose, what you attempt, what you dare to reach for, all of it shapes the terrain beneath your feet. I don't want to pretend that one step solves everything. It doesn't. You will still have days when doubt snarls at your ankles, days when your momentum slows. Days when the old stories try to seduce you back into hesitation. But once you've tasted motion, you know the alternative too well to stay still for long. You know the cost of waiting. You know what it feels like to betray your own becoming, and knowing that makes movement easier to return to, even after you've stumbled. The moment you finally move isn't a single decisive instant. It's a doorway. The frame might be narrow, but what waits on the other side is the life you've been circling. A life shaped not by the dreams you've protected in your mind, but by the steps you've dared to take in the real, imperfect world. If you're reading this, maybe that doorway is already in front of you. Maybe something in your life is whispering that it's time. Not because you're ready, but because you're tired of not moving. If so, trust the whisper. You don't need a breakthrough. You don't need certainty. You don't need a perfect plan. You need one small, honest step. Just one. And then another. Chapter 2. The weight you don't realize you're carrying. Often you don't know you're carrying something heavy until the moment you finally put it down. You walk through your days with a particular strain in your shoulders, a tension woven so quietly into your body that it becomes indistinguishable from who you think you are. You adapt to it the way people adapt to a limp or a bruise or a chronic ache. They stop noticing until someone asks when the pain began and they realize they can't remember a time it wasn't there. The invisible burdens we accumulate behave like that. They settle in slowly, almost politely, until they feel like part of the landscape. And because they don't announce themselves with drama or urgency, we rarely question their presence. We simply learn to live around them. The weight I'm talking about rarely looks like hardship from the outside. It's subtler than grief, quieter than heartbreak, less obvious than the big life-shaking crises that demand your attention. This weight is built from accumulated moments of self-doubt, the lingering responsibilities you never truly agreed to carry, the unspoken expectations that attach themselves to you because you've grown too used to saying yes, or because saying no has always felt like a betrayal. Sometimes it's the pressure to be a certain kind of person or to maintain a life that doesn't feel quite like yours anymore. Sometimes it's the belief that you owe the world more than you owe yourself. Sometimes it's a story about what you can or cannot do that was never yours to begin with. I didn't know how much weight I carried until a friend asked a simple question, one that should have been easy to answer. What do you want? Not what should you do, or what makes sense, or what would be responsible, but what do you want? I opened my mouth to respond, and nothing came out, not a single coherent thought. It was as though someone had yanked the cord on a lamp that had quietly been flickering for years and revealed that the bulb had burned out a long time ago. I had spent so much time thinking about the needs of others, the logistics of my days, the expectations I'd inherited, the fears that kept me still, that I had neglected the one question that should have been a compass. In that silence, I felt the weight of everything I had been carrying. I felt its shape, its density, its years. You may be carrying more than you know, and the difficult part is that the world will reward you for it. People admire those who shoulder more than they can reasonably bear. They call it strength, loyalty, dedication. They applaud the ones who never falter, who always show up, who pour from an endlessly replenishing well. They don't see the exhaustion pooling beneath your ribs or the resentment quietly forming where your joy once lived. They don't notice because you've trained them not to. You've trained yourself not to. And over time, you start to believe the myth that you were built to carry more, when in truth you were simply too afraid to put anything down. There is a strange comfort in carrying too much. It gives you a reason for your stillness. It gives you an explanation for your hesitation. You can point to the weight and say, "Of course I'm not moving. I'm already overloaded." What you can't see is how much of that load is yours to release. Most of us don't examine our burdens. We assume they are fixed. We think of them as obligations rather than choices. But so much of what weighs us down wasn't chosen consciously. It was inherited or absorbed or assumed. It's the emotional debris of years spent trying to be the version of ourselves the world seemed to want. When I finally examined my own burdens, I realized how many were built from stories I had internalized long before I had the wisdom to question them. Stories like, "You're responsible for keeping everyone happy. You must prove your worth through effort. Rest is something you earn, not something you need. Your dreams should always defer to practicality. Don't ask for too much. Don't risk disappointing anyone. Don't fail." These stories sound harmless because they often come from well-meaning places, but they accumulate like sediment, and the more you carry, the less room you have for your own life. The problem with invisible weight is that it keeps you suspended, somewhere between movement and paralysis. You want to begin, but your energy is siphoned into obligations you never chose. You want to make changes, but you're exhausted before you even start. You want to take action, but the action feels impossible because the moment you imagine stepping forward, the things you're carrying pull you back. You blame yourself for not being stronger, more disciplined, more organized. But it's not about strength, it's about weight, and no one moves freely when they're carrying too much. One of the first steps toward reclaiming your momentum is noticing what's in your hands. This noticing is not glamorous. It isn't even comfortable. It requires a kind of emotional honesty that can feel almost disorienting at first. You have to look at your life and ask, "What here is mine, truly mine? What am I carrying because I'm afraid to put it down? What am I holding because someone told me long ago that I should? What burden have I mistaken for identity?" It took me years to realize how much of my hesitation came from weight that wasn't mine. Weight I'd inherited from family narratives about responsibility. Weight I'd picked up from old fears about disappointing people. Weight I'd accepted because I was afraid that putting anything down would make me appear selfish or ungrateful or unkind. But the truth is that releasing what isn't yours is an act of kindness, not selfishness. It frees you to participate in your life instead of surviving it. It frees you to move. There's a memory I return to often when thinking about this. I was helping a friend move apartments, and at one point she asked me to lift a box that turned out to be filled with books. I didn't know that when I lifted it. I bent down, expecting something manageable, and when the weight pulled me downward harder than I anticipated, I stumbled. Not because the weight was too heavy for me, but because I hadn't braced myself, I didn't know what I was lifting. Life is like that. You stumble not because you're incapable, but because you never realized how heavy the box had become. And here's the odd thing. Once I realized how heavy that box was, I didn't feel ashamed for stumbling. I felt relieved. There was a clarity in understanding the true weight of what I was trying to lift. That clarity made it easier to adjust, easier to ask for help, easier to proceed without feeling like the difficulty was evidence of some personal flaw. Awareness changes everything. When you know what you're carrying, you can decide whether to keep carrying it. The moments that lead to change often start with the quiet acknowledgement that you are tired. Not the kind of tired that sleep cures, but the deep inner fatigue that comes from supporting a life that isn't shaped to your actual size. And when that fatigue becomes undeniable, you begin to wonder whether it's possible to live differently. That wondering is the first crack in the weight, the first opening. What most people don't realize is that letting go isn't always dramatic. Sometimes it's as simple as telling the truth, to yourself first, and then to others. Sometimes it's admitting you're not okay with the role you've been playing. Sometimes it's canceling a commitment you never truly wanted. Sometimes it's giving yourself permission not to be everything to everyone. These are small motions, but small motions can release massive weight. When you start to put things down, you don't lighten only your days, you lighten your mind. You make space for your own desire to reappear. You make it possible to hear your own voice again, that voice that has been buried under years of effort and expectations. And once your voice returns, movement becomes easier. You begin to see paths you didn't know were available. You begin to feel possibilities where before you only felt obligation. Imagine standing at the edge of a field with a heavy pack strapped to your back. You've worn it for so long that you no longer feel its individual contents. You just feel the pressure, the drag. Someone comes along and asks if you've ever looked inside the pack. You shake your head. Why would you? It's always been there. It's always been heavy. You assume the heaviness is simply part of existence, but one day you unbuckle the straps. You slide the pack onto the ground. You open it, and inside are things you no longer need. Old fears, outdated roles, promises you made when you were young and didn't know better, expectations that never belonged to you at all. You realize you've built your life around the assumption that this pack must always stay on your back, but it doesn't. This realization isn't liberating in a sudden, euphoric way. It's gentler, deeper. It feels like a long exhale after years of holding your breath. It feels like space. It feels like the possibility of stepping forward without the familiar drag behind you. And that's when you see it. The weight was never your destiny. It was simply what you carried because no one told you that you could set it down. Movement becomes possible the moment you free your hands. And the moment you free your hands, your life begins to open, not all at once, not dramatically, but undeniably. The weight you don't realize you're carrying is the very thing standing between you and the next step, and you are allowed to put it down. Chapter 3. Why we wait for perfect. Eventually there comes a day when you realize you've been waiting for something that isn't coming. You don't admit it at first. You tell yourself you're being patient, thoughtful, selective. You say you're giving yourself time to prepare, time to mature, time to become the kind of person who doesn't stumble or fail or embarrass themselves. You imagine that when this mysterious perfect moment arrives, it will be unmistakable, like a bright sign flashing in the sky, announcing that the conditions are finally ideal, that you can take the leap without fear, without uncertainty, without the awkward tremble that comes with beginning anything real. This fantasy is comforting because it suggests that someday you will be able to act without risk. But the longer you wait, the more you begin to suspect a quiet truth. Maybe the perfect moment isn't late. Maybe it doesn't exist at all. The chase for perfection often begins quietly, long before we realize what we're chasing. It grows out of an early instinct to avoid pain, mistakes, criticism, failure, disappointment, exposure. We learn quickly that doing something imperfectly can invite judgment or rejection, so we tell ourselves that next time we'll wait until we're absolutely sure. We won't write the thing until we know it will impress. We won't take the class until we're convinced we won't be the worst one in the room. We won't start the project until we have all the skills. We won't try the relationship until we're certain we won't get hurt. We become curators of our own possibility, editing out anything that feels risky or uncertain. But editing possibility has a steep cost. Eventually, there's nothing left to begin. When I look back on my life, I can trace entire stretches of lost time to this belief in perfection. I didn't call it perfection then. I called it waiting, waiting to feel ready, waiting for inspiration, waiting for a sign, waiting for the fear to shrink just enough that I could step forward without shaking. But underneath all that waiting was a single hope, that somehow I could bypass the discomfort of being a beginner. I wanted the finished version of myself to show up first, to ease me into the life I imagined. And because that finished version never arrived, neither did the beginning. The trouble with waiting for perfect is that it masquerades as responsibility. It feels thoughtful, careful, conscientious. You convince yourself that you're doing the sensible thing by delaying. You're being smart, you think. You're avoiding unnecessary risk. You're ensuring a better outcome. But what you're really doing is negotiating with fear. And fear is a relentless negotiator. It always asks for more time, more certainty, more guarantee. It promises comfort if you just wait a little longer. But the comfort never comes, and the waiting becomes its own form of paralysis. I used to believe perfectionism was about wanting everything to be flawless, but now I think perfectionism is about control. An attempt to shield ourselves from the unpredictable, the uncontrollable, the parts of life that can't be managed into submission. The fear isn't that the thing we're trying will be imperfect. The fear is that we will be exposed, that our effort will reveal our limits, that our attempts will make us visible, vulnerable, disappointed, or disappointing. So we construct this idea of the perfect moment as a way to postpone the confrontation. If we never begin, we never lose, but we also never live. There is a conversation I had years ago that still echoes in me. I was speaking with a woman who had dreamed of starting her own small business. She had the idea, she had the skill, she even had the time, but she told me she was waiting for a moment when she felt more confident. "I just feel like I need to be a little more together," she said. I understood that feeling all too well, so I asked her how long she'd been waiting. She paused, then laughed in this soft, self-conscious way. "Maybe 10 years," she said. 10 years of a life spent preparing for a moment she believed would one day arrive. 10 years waiting for a feeling that never materialized. Because confidence doesn't grow in anticipation, it grows in motion. Most people underestimate how deeply fear uses perfection as a shield. Fear doesn't want to stop you. It wants to slow you enough that you lose momentum. It wants to keep you thinking instead of doing. It wants you rehearsing the possibility of failure so vividly that the rehearsal itself feels like failure. Fear doesn't need you to quit, it only needs you to hesitate. Perfectionism is its favorite strategy because perfection sounds noble. It sounds admirable, it sounds like high standards, but really it's just fear wearing expensive clothes. One of the most painful truths I've had to learn is that perfection is often a form of self-protection. We tell ourselves we want the perfect moment so we can succeed, but what we really want is insulation from vulnerability. We want a guarantee that we won't feel foolish. We want assurance that our efforts won't be wasted, but there is no creative, relational, physical, emotional, or spiritual journey that begins with guarantees. There is only the beginning. And the beginning is always imperfect. There was a stretch of time when I kept putting off writing a book, the very one you're reading now. I kept telling myself that I wasn't ready, I needed to organize my thoughts, I needed to learn more, I needed to become wiser, more articulate, more insightful. But underneath all those excuses was a fear that the book wouldn't live up to the version of it that existed in my mind. In my mind, it was profound, moving, refined. On the page, I feared it would be clumsy, unpolished, disappointing, and the distance between the imagined masterpiece and the real, imperfect effort felt so wide that I convinced myself it was better to wait. But one morning in the middle of this waiting, I had a sudden thought, not a revelation, just a quiet truth settling into place. A real imperfect book is infinitely more powerful than a perfect imaginary one. The imagined book couldn't reach anyone. It couldn't help anyone. It couldn't comfort or challenge or accompany anyone. It existed only in my mind, pristine and useless. The real book, the one I was avoiding, was the only version that could do anything meaningful. And in that moment, I understood something essential. Perfect things don't change people. Real things do. When we wait for perfect, we rob ourselves of the richness of real experience. We miss the lessons that come only through engagement. We miss the relationships that begin only when we risk connection. We miss the opportunities that appear only when we step forward. Life doesn't reward the people who imagine themselves into readiness. It rewards the ones who are willing to participate even while trembling. I've never met a person who genuinely improved their life by waiting until everything was perfect. I've met many who lost years that way. And if you're honest with yourself, you may see the places where you've done the same. Where you've told yourself you needed more time, more certainty, more strength. Where you've held your breath, waiting for a moment that never announces itself. What changes us? What moves us is not readiness but willingness. Willingness to begin even when our hands shake. Willingness to show up before we feel like we belong. Willingness to let our first attempts be messy. Willingness to step into a life that is built moment by imperfect moment rather than engineered into flawlessness. Perfection is a beautiful idea that cannot support the weight of a real life. Real lives are textured, they're unpredictable, they're thick with contradictions, detours, and second tries. Real lives require presence, not perfection. They require courage, not certainty. They require action, not endless preparation. So if you have something you've been postponing, something you keep telling yourself you'll begin once everything aligns, I'll offer you the truth I wish someone had offered me earlier. Alignment comes after the first step. Confidence comes after the first attempt. Clarity comes after the first messy draft. Strength comes after the first trembling try. You don't need to be perfect to begin. You only need to begin. Eventually, the perfect moment reveals itself for what it is, a myth. And in the space where the myth dissolves, you find something better, an imperfect, unglamorous, deeply human invitation to act anyway. Take it. It's the only one that's real. Chapter 4. The Gravity of Small Beginnings. Perhaps the hardest thing to believe, especially when you've spent years waiting for your life to shift, is that most transformations begin so quietly you almost overlook them. We're trained by stories, movies, novels, dramatic biographies, to expect the turning points in our lives to come with thunderclaps, some dramatic disruption, some unmistakable sign, some collision with fate that sweeps us into a new direction. But the real beginnings, the ones that alter the trajectory of an ordinary life, tend to appear in much humbler forms. They slip into your days disguised as tiny choices, small shifts in intention, modest acts that seem too insignificant to matter. Yet these are the beginnings that pull the story forward. These are the beginnings that change everything. I used to dismiss small steps as pointless. When I felt stuck, I wanted big answers, big movement, big change. If I couldn't overhaul my life in some sweeping cinematic fashion, I thought I was failing. To do something small felt like settling. It felt like admitting that the larger change I longed for was too far out of reach. But the truth is, I wasn't rejecting small steps because they were ineffective. I was rejecting them because they required they required me to accept that progress is not glamorous, that momentum is often built through unremarkable repetitions, that change rarely arrives as a lightning bolt, but instead as a slow and steady thaw. And humility, though necessary, can be uncomfortable, especially when you've spent too long imagining what your life should look like. There was a period in my life when I kept telling myself that if I couldn't take the real first step, the meaningful one, the impressive one, then I shouldn't start at all. I preferred the fantasy of a dramatic leap to the reality of a modest inch. I thought the leap would prove something about who I was, bold, decisive, ready. But life kept offering me inches instead of leaps, and rather than taking them, I ignored them and waited for the perfect moment to arrive. It never did. Small beginnings have a gravity that is easy to underestimate. Gravity isn't loud. It doesn't announce itself with spectacle. It works in the background, pulling things slowly but steadily in its direction. A single small action has that same kind of pull. Once you take it, your life begins to bend, ever so subtly, toward motion rather than stagnation. You might not notice the shift right away, but something deep within you registers it. A part of you that has been dormant awakens and whispers, "We're moving now." And that whisper, repeated over days and weeks, becomes a kind of inner momentum. I think about a morning a few years ago when I was struggling with a writing project I'd avoided for months. Every time I sat down, the pressure to create something meaningful crushed whatever spark of creativity I had left, so I avoided the work entirely. Days passed, then weeks. I didn't even tell myself I'd finish the project later. I simply stopped thinking about it because thinking about it hurt. One morning, though, I sat at my desk with no grand plan, no surge of motivation. I simply told myself I would write one paragraph. Not a good paragraph, not even a coherent paragraph. Just one. That paragraph was terrible. But it was also the first piece of real writing I'd done in nearly half a year, and something about that simple act, moving my hands across the keyboard, placing imperfect sentences where previously there had been silence, shifted something in me. The next day, I wrote a few more lines. The day after that, a little more. Within a few weeks, the project I had abandoned began to take shape again. But it didn't happen because I suddenly found confidence. It happened because I allowed myself to take a step small enough that fear didn't have the time or space to stop me. It's astonishing how many people never start because they believe their first step must be impressive. They want the beginning to be worthy of the dream. They want to start with passion, determination, clarity, but beginnings are clumsy things. They wobble, they falter, they lack elegance. They're made from guesswork and hesitation and the fragile hope that maybe this time we won't abandon ourselves halfway through. Small beginnings don't feel like triumphs. They feel like uncertain gestures, quiet and awkward. But those gestures matter more than you think. I've met people who have carried dreams for decades. Writing a book, starting a business, learning a craft, changing careers. When I ask what keeps them from beginning, the answers vary, but the theme is the same. They want to start in a way that feels definitive. They want a beginning that reflects their seriousness. But the irony is that seriousness doesn't reveal itself in dramatic starts. It reveals itself in sustained, humble effort. A person who takes one step each day is more committed than someone who takes one grand step once a year. Small beginnings demand something different than bravery. They require forgiveness. You have to forgive yourself for not being further along. You have to forgive yourself for the time you've already lost. You have to forgive your own awkwardness, your own fear, your own imperfections. When you take a small step, you are acknowledging that you are not the flawless version of yourself you once imagined. You are real, you are flawed, and you are moving anyway. That's where momentum begins. I think about people who start running by jogging to the end of their block, people who start painting by buying a single brush, people who start healing by admitting they're hurting, people who start speaking up by saying one honest thing aloud. These beginnings don't look like much from the outside, but internally they are tectonic. They mark the moment when a person stops waiting for the perfect circumstances and instead chooses to inhabit their life as it is, and that choice changes everything. The gravity of small beginnings is this: once you take one step, you are no longer the version of yourself who hasn't started. That other version, hesitant, paralyzed, waiting, is gone. Even if you falter later, even if you take two steps back, something irreversible has happened. You have proven to yourself that movement is possible. You have touched the truth that your life responds to your effort. You know now, in your bones, that you can act. That knowledge is far more powerful than any perfect plan. When you think back on the turning points in your life, you'll probably find that many of them began in quiet ways. Not with the dramatic decisions you agonized over, but with the small ones you barely recognized as significant. The moment you said yes to something modest, the moment you declined something that drained you, the moment you decided to show up once instead of not at all. These moments compound. Momentum is built from the repetition of ordinary courage. One day you take a small step. The next day you take another. The day after that you take two. Eventually, those small steps accumulate into something that looks, from a distance, like confidence, like discipline, like resilience. But really, it's just the compounded effect of showing up in small ways again and again. The people whose lives seem to flow forward with ease rarely leap. They lean. They lean into motion, into curiosity, into willingness. They trust the gravity of small steps. I used to think I needed to be overwhelmed by motivation, that I needed to feel something powerful enough to override all my fear. But now I think the opposite is true. You don't need overwhelming motivation. You need a reason small enough to begin, a reason you don't have to negotiate with, a reason fear can't easily dismantle. Just 5 minutes is harder for fear to argue with than start a lifelong habit. Write one sentence is harder to sabotage than write a chapter. Walk outside is easier to attempt than become healthy. The smaller the beginning, the less room fear has to interfere. Small beginnings are not evidence of a small life. They are evidence of a life that understands how growth works. A seed is small. So is a spark. So is the first page of any book that ever mattered. But give a seed time. Give a spark oxygen. Give a page a few hundred more, and you have something that can change you. When people tell me they feel stuck, what they're really saying is that they've forgotten the power of the smallest possible move. They think they need to build momentum before they start, but momentum is something you build through starting, not before. You cannot think yourself into motion. And the moment you accept that truth, something inside you loosens. You stop demanding that the beginning look a certain way. You stop waiting to feel worthy of the journey. You stop insisting that your first attempt be impressive. You begin quietly, imperfectly, honestly. And in doing so, you make yourself available to the unfolding of a new life. Perhaps small beginnings are the most sacred kind. They are the ones that ask you to trust without proof, to move without certainty, to believe in a future you cannot yet see. They are the ones that turn hesitation into motion. They are the ones that change you from the inside out, and they are available to you today. Chapter 5. When doubt sounds like wisdom. Silently, doubt learns to mimic the tone of your better judgment. It doesn't arrive wearing the face of fear, not at first. It slips in sounding measured, reasonable, protective. It uses the same voice you rely on when you make responsible decisions, and that is what makes it so convincing. Doubt isn't always the loud, dramatic no that blocks your path. More often, it's the quiet maybe you keep returning to, the gentle tug that encourages you to reconsider your instincts, the whisper that suggests you wait just a little longer until you know for sure. It doesn't feel like sabotage. It feels like caution. It feels like maturity. But beneath its careful tone lies something far less noble, a deep, immobilizing hesitance that keeps you living smaller than your desire. I've learned that doubt thrives in the spaces where our longing threatens to grow. It senses when you're on the edge of expansion, when you're about to step into something that will require you to be seen in a fuller, less controlled way. And right there, on the brink of becoming, doubt pulls up a chair and begins offering its quiet advice. Not blatant discouragement, that would be too easy to reject. Instead, it adopts the language of practical wisdom. Are you sure this is the right time? Maybe you should get more information first. What if you're not quite ready? Shouldn't you wait until the chaos in your life settles down? It's the voice of a false caretaker, someone who claims to be protecting you while quietly keeping you small. There was a decision I once postponed for nearly 3 years because doubt convinced me it was too soon. I told myself I was being responsible, that I needed to improve, gather more experience, think it through from every angle. And whenever the desire to finally move grew too large to ignore, doubt tightened its grip by whispering the one phrase that has stopped more lives than any other. What if you fail? I believed that question meant danger. I believed it was proof I was being reckless. Only later did I realize that the question didn't indicate danger. It indicated importance. I feared failing at that thing precisely because I cared about it. The fear wasn't a warning, it was a compass, pointing towards something meaningful. Doubt is most persuasive when it uses truth to distort possibility. It doesn't lie outright, it selects the truths that make movement feel risky and ignores the ones that make movement worthwhile. If you want to start something new, doubt will remind you of every time you quit before. If you want to try something unfamiliar, doubt will summon the memory of when things didn't work out. If you want to speak up, doubt will conjure the moments you felt foolish. If you want to love bravely, doubt will recount every heartbreak you've ever known. It pulls from the archives of your life with a librarian's precision, selecting the files guaranteed to freeze you in place. And because these memories are real, doubt feels trustworthy. But it will not remind you of your resilience. It will not show you the times you succeeded despite fear. It will not highlight the countless moments you grew from difficult situations. Doubt is generous with evidence, but stingy with truth. One of the most deceptive things about doubt is that it often emerges strongest right before real change happens. Your desire builds, your vision sharpens, your courage begins stirring, and then suddenly doubt appears, more insistent than ever. That timing can feel like a warning, the universe telling you to stop. But I've come to believe it means the opposite. Doubt flares up when you are getting close to a threshold, when the life you've known senses the nearness of a life that asks more of you. It's the last resistance before the shift. You'll notice that doubt rarely interferes when you're thinking small. It saves its energy for the moments you consider becoming larger. That alone should tell you something. Experts say, doubt. I remember watching a friend struggle with a simple but meaningful choice. She wanted to apply for a creative program she'd secretly dreamed about for years. She had the talent, she had the passion, she had the time. What she didn't have was the certainty that she would be accepted. And because she wasn't certain, she hesitated. She told herself she needed to prepare more. But the preparation she imagined was vague, endless, undefined. When I asked her what she feared most, she said, "I'm afraid that applying will make me look like I think I'm good enough." That sentence has stayed with me ever since. Not because it was unusual, but because it was heartbreakingly common. Doubt had convinced her that trying itself was arrogant, that wanting something made her presumptuous, that hope was something she hadn't yet earned. But doubt is not a judge. It's not a voice of truth. It's a voice of protection that doesn't know how to differentiate between danger and growth. It cannot distinguish between the discomfort that harms you and the discomfort that expands you. To doubt, all discomfort is treated the same, as something to avoid at all costs. When I finally recognized this, something shifted in me. I realized that doubt would never cheer for my expansion. It would never applaud my courage. It would never say, "You're ready now." That meant the responsibility for moving, despite the discomfort, despite the trembling, despite the uncertainty, was mine alone. And strangely, that realization didn't feel heavy. It felt freeing. I no longer needed doubt's approval to step forward. I no longer had to wait for the voice that said be careful to transform into the voice that said go. That transformation was never going to happen. Here is something I wish I had known sooner. Doubt doesn't disappear when you gain confidence. It disappears when you stop treating it as the authority. When you hear doubt and say, "Ah, there you are," instead of, "You must be right." When you learn to separate its tone from the truth. When you learn to recognize that the voice trying to protect you from embarrassment is the same voice protecting you from possibility. There is a gentler way to move through doubt, not by silencing it, but by reframing it. When doubt says you're not ready, you can respond, "Maybe," but readiness grows through action. When doubt says you might fail, you can say yes, and failure is survivable. When doubt says, "What will people think?" you might whisper, "People think about themselves far more than they think about me." When doubt says, "What if you're wrong?" you can tell it, "Being wrong is still a form of movement." The power shifts, not when doubt goes away, but when you stop assuming it knows anything about your future. There's a moment, you may have felt it, when doubt disguises itself as wisdom so effectively that you mistake paralysis for thoughtfulness. You think your caution is maturity, when in truth it's the familiar fear of stepping into a life that asks you to risk being seen. But wisdom and doubt have one crucial difference. Wisdom encourages motion, while doubt delays it. Wisdom says, "Take the step, but do it consciously." Doubt says, "Don't take the step at all." One opens your life, the other closes it. If you want to know whether the voice speaking inside you is doubt or wisdom, listen to what it pushes you toward. Wisdom expands your world. Doubt shrinks it. And maybe the most painful truth of all is this. Doubt often feels truest when you've been standing still for too long. Stillness breeds self-suspicion. When you're not moving, you begin to imagine the dangers of movement as far greater than they are. But when you start moving, when you take even the smallest step, your perspective changes. You realize the path isn't as fragile as doubt made it seem. You realize your strength is far greater than you believed. You realize that the fear you were protecting yourself from was largely imagined. I've never met a person who regretted taking a sincere step forward, even if that step led them somewhere unexpected. But I've met countless people who regret the years they spent listening to doubt masquerade as caution. The years they lost waiting for proof that they were allowed to try. The years they spent dimming their own hopes so they wouldn't have to face the possibility of failing. The truth is, doubt will always speak. It will always offer its familiar script. It will always try to cloak itself in wisdom. But you don't have to obey it. You don't have to argue with it. You simply have to move anyway. Motion is the only force I've ever found that weakens doubt. Not confidence, not planning, not reassurance. Motion. Because every time you move, you gather evidence that the ground beneath you can hold your weight. You gather proof that you can survive discomfort, that you can navigate uncertainty, that you can create a life through action rather than avoidance. And slowly, quietly, you begin to trust yourself more than the voice that once ruled you. The moment you realize that doubt is not your enemy but simply a frightened part of you trying to keep you safe, something opens. You begin to carry it differently. You stop letting it dictate the size of your life, and then, in that widening space, you step forward, even while trembling, even while unsure, even while doubt still whispers at your heels. That step is what doubt fears most. And that step is where your life begins again. Chapter 6. The Quiet Courage of Trying Anyway. Gradually you learn that courage is far less explosive than you once imagined. It doesn't arrive as a surge of bravery flooding your system, lifting you into motion like some triumphant swell in a soundtrack. It rarely feels like a declaration or a transformation. Instead, it gathers itself inside you in small, steady increments. Almost imperceptible at first, quiet as breath, subtle as a shift in temperature. You don't wake up one morning suddenly fearless. You wake up and notice that even with the fear still humming beneath your ribs, you're leaning just a little more toward the thing you've been avoiding. Courage, as it turns out, grows like dawn. Softly, slowly, light accumulating until you can see where you're going. For a long time, I misunderstood courage. I believed it was something other people had, people who seemed naturally bold, who launched themselves into new experiences as though hesitation were a foreign language they'd never learn. I imagined courage as a kind of internal fire you either possessed or didn't, a flame that burned reliably and brightly. If I didn't feel bold enough to do the thing I longed to do, I told myself it meant I lacked courage. I assumed my fear disqualified me from beginning. But what I've learned, through mistakes, through years of hesitating, through watching myself and others try, fail, and try again, is that courage is not the absence of fear, nor is it even the opposite of fear. Courage is the small decision that fear does not get to choose the direction of your life. It's not loud, it's not sweeping, it's rarely even comfortable. But it is a decision, a quiet one, made again and again from inside the trembling. The people who appear fearless are not people without fear, they are people who have learned to move with it. And that is a different kind of bravery entirely. There was a season of my life when I felt paralyzed by a difficult decision. I kept trying to muster the courage to make a change I knew I needed to make. But the fear around it was so dense that every attempt felt like running into a wall. I kept waiting for a moment when I'd feel clear, certain, fortified. That moment never came. What came instead was a morning when the indecision itself became unbearable. I didn't suddenly feel brave. I simply felt tired of letting fear keep its hands on the steering wheel, and in that tiredness, something softened. I didn't feel courageous, but I felt willing. Sometimes that's enough. I took one small action, then another, and even though I shook through all of it, I kept going. The trembling didn't mean I was weak. It meant I was learning to live in the space between fear and motion, a space most of us try to avoid, but that ultimately becomes the birthplace of every meaningful shift. Trying, anyway, that's the real courage, not the polished version you hear in speeches or see captured in neatly framed photos, but the raw, unglamorous kind, the kind where your heart is pounding, where you doubt every step, where your voice wavers, where you feel the familiar urge to retreat, but you keep inching forward. People often talk about courage as though it requires certainty, as though you need a clear map before you begin. But courage has far more to do with stepping into the unknown than walking a path carved neatly ahead of you. The courage that changes lives is the courage that operates without guarantees. You don't know if this choice will work out. You don't know if you're strong enough, skilled enough, ready enough. You just know that staying where you are is slowly becoming more painful than the risk of moving. That tension, the ache of staying paired with the fear of moving, is where courage grows. I've watched people decide to try anyway in moments so small you might miss them if you weren't paying attention. A man returning to therapy after swearing he'd given up on himself. A woman making a phone call she'd been dreading for months. An artist sharing her work publicly for the first time. A partner attempting a vulnerable conversation instead of retreating behind silence. A teenager applying to a school he didn't think he deserved. None of these moments were grand or dramatic, but each one required someone to override the instinct to hide. Each one demanded that they move towards something their fear insisted they were not ready for. And in each case, that movement, quiet as it was, shifted the trajectory of their life. Trying, anyway, is not a mindset. It's a practice. A practice of acknowledging the fear without surrendering to it. A practice of accepting imperfection. A practice of letting your desire, even the faintest thread of it, have a say in the choices you make. Fear is persuasive. It knows exactly which buttons to press. It knows how to shape itself into logic and caution, how to disguise itself as responsibility. But fear has a singular agenda, preservation, not fulfillment. It cares only about keeping you safe, not about expanding your life or aligning you with your purpose. That's why courage must sometimes look like defiance. Soft, steady defiance. A willingness to choose growth over comfort, uncertainty over stagnation. There's a memory that still sits quietly in me, one that reshaped how I understand courage. It was years ago, in a small community class I was teaching. A woman, introverted, thoughtful, gentle, had been working on a personal project she refused to share aloud. Every week she came to class, listened intently, took notes, participated without drawing attention to herself. But whenever we reached the portion where participants were invited to share, she went still, almost frozen. I could see the longing in her eyes, this deep desire to speak, but also the fear pinning her in place. Then, one evening, after months of silence, she raised her hand. Her voice shook so visibly that the room held its breath. She shared her work, quietly, haltingly, but she shared it. When she finished, she exhaled in this way that I will never forget. It wasn't pride. It wasn't relief. It was something more tender, more profound, something like reclamation. Later, she told me she had been terrified the entire time. Her palms had been sweating, her chest tight, her heartbeat thundering. But I knew, she said, that if I didn't do it that night, I might never do it. That moment changed her. Not because the sharing itself was dramatic, but because she learned something essential. Her fear did not have absolute authority. She could act even while afraid. That truth stayed with her. It stays with all of us once we learn it. Trying, anyway, is not glamorous work. It's interior work. It's emotional labor. It's the quiet willingness to move through discomfort rather than around it. And because it's quiet, it's easy to assume it doesn't count. But the courage that doesn't draw attention, the courage no one applauds, the courage no one sees, is often the kind that shapes you most deeply. The world tends to reward the visible forms of courage: public achievements, grand gestures, impressive leaps. But the inner forms, the whispered yes, the second try after disappointment, the choice to speak up, the choice to stay open, the choice to hope again, those are the ones that build the foundation of your life. They strengthen something in you that becomes unshakable over time. Every time you try anyway, you send a quiet message to yourself: I am willing to participate in my own becoming. I am willing to risk being imperfect. I am willing to live a life shaped by action rather than avoidance. That message, repeated again and again, becomes a kind of inner trust. You begin to count on yourself. You begin to believe that you can handle what life asks of you. And when fear arises, as it always will, you no longer treat it as an immovable barrier. You recognize it as a traveling companion, not a ruler. Your life will be built not on the days you felt brave, but on the days you acted without feeling brave, the days you tried anyway, the days you took a step even though your mind insisted you weren't ready. Those are the days that shape your direction. Those are the days that reveal the truth about who you are. And quietly, gradually, something shifts. You start to trust motion more than fear. You start to trust your own resilience more than the imagined disasters that have kept you paused. You start to sense that the life you want is not waiting for perfection or certainty. It's waiting for participation. Trying anyway is how you participate. It's how you reclaim your momentum. It's how you inch closer to the person you're becoming. Not with fanfare. Not with confidence, but with willingness. And willingness, humble, persistent, imperfect willingness, has carried more people across thresholds than courage ever has. Trying anyway is not the fallback option, it's the doorway. And it's open right now. Chapter 7. Breaking the Spell of Hesitation. Unseen forces shape the moments when we freeze. You don't notice them at first because they operate quietly, like subtle currents beneath the surface of your days. They weave themselves into your thoughts, tug gently at your instincts, tighten around your impulses until you begin to confuse their grip with your own nature. Hesitation doesn't usually appear as a dramatic halt. It builds gradually, softly, until the pause becomes familiar, and the familiar becomes comfortable, and the comfortable becomes a kind of trance. And in that trance, you start to believe that standing still is safer than moving. The spell of hesitation is powerful, not because it stops you abruptly, but because it convinces you that not moving is the right choice. It paints stillness as thoughtfulness, delay as discernment, inaction as caution. It cloaks fear in the language of responsibility, and by the time you begin to question it, you've already lost days or weeks or years to a subtle paralysis that doesn't feel like paralysis at all. It feels like waiting. I know that trance well. There was a long stretch of my life when hesitation felt like my default setting. I wasn't unhappy, exactly. I wasn't stuck in the catastrophic sense that some people experience. My life was fine, stable, functional. But beneath that stability was a persistent sense of half-livedness, a quiet awareness that I was circling the edges of the life I meant to inhabit. I kept thinking the right moment would eventually arrive, some unmistakable internal signal that would release me into motion, but the right moment never appeared, and the hesitation deepened. What I didn't realize then is that hesitation doesn't dissolve with time. It strengthens. It settles into your bones. It becomes a reflex. The longer you wait to act, the harder acting becomes. And the harder acting becomes, the more you think you need to wait. It's a loop, a whispering, tightening loop. that convinces you that movement will be easier tomorrow or next week or next season, but tomorrow arrives with the same hesitation, and the season after that, and the one after that. At some point you wake up and realize that hesitation has become a habit, one you never meant to form, one that quietly shaped the architecture of your days. I once heard someone describe hesitation as emotional static, the noise that crackles when your desire and your fear collide. I think that's close, but not quite complete. Hesitation is more like a fog. It doesn't hurt, it doesn't shout, it doesn't make declarations. It simply blurs the path forward until you stop trusting your own direction. You don't turn back, but you don't proceed. You hover in a strange middle place where your longing remains alive, but unexpressed. Breaking that spell requires something deceptively simple, a single undeniable moment of motion. Not a grand decision, not a sweeping change. A motion small enough that hesitation can't disguise it or reinterpret it or dismiss it. A motion so clear that even you can't deny that something has shifted. I didn't understand this until the day I caught myself doing something I'd avoided for months. Sending an email that felt vulnerable. Starting a piece of writing I'd postponed. Reaching out to someone I missed. That tiny action didn't fix everything, but it cracked the spell. It proved that hesitation, though powerful, wasn't absolute. The strange thing about hesitation is that it builds a story more than it builds a barrier. It tells you a narrative about yourself, that you're not ready, not capable, not steady enough. It insists that your desire is premature or unrealistic. It suggests that movement is irresponsible, and the longer you accept that narrative, the more you forget that it's a story, not a truth. Breaking the spell means interrupting the story, reminding yourself that you're not the person hesitation insists you are. But here's the part that took me years to learn. Hesitation isn't your enemy. It's your protector. A misguided one, yes, but a protector all the same. It arises because some part of you is convinced that moving forward will expose you to danger. Emotional, relational, reputational, existential danger. It thinks the world is safer if you stay still, and because that instinct comes from a place deep within you, a place shaped by old wounds or old fears or old beliefs about what you're capable of, the hesitation feels like wisdom. It feels like care. When I finally understood this, that hesitation was a misguided form of self-protection, I felt something soften. Instead of treating it as a force to fight, I began to treat it as a signal, a reminder that a younger, more fearful part of me was trying to keep me safe. And safety, ironically, was what I needed to offer myself in order to move. Not the performative kind of safety that pretends fear doesn't exist, but the grounded kind that says, "I know you're scared. I know this feels risky. I'm not going to abandon you, but we have to go anyway." Once you stop fighting hesitation and start understanding it, something shifts. You begin to see the space between the fear and the action. You begin to realize that those two things can coexist. You begin to feel the possibility of movement even in moments when everything inside you urges caution. That's not bravery, it's clarity, and clarity is often stronger than courage. If hesitation has been with you for a long time, you might believe that it's part of who you are. That you're naturally indecisive, that you're someone who needs more time than others, that you lack the instinct for action. But that's not true. Hesitation is not a trait, it's a pattern. And patterns can change. They don't change through force or through self-criticism. They change through gentle, persistent interruption. You interrupt hesitation by moving in ways so small they feel almost inconsequential. You stand up when you want to stay seated. You write one sentence when you'd rather avoid the page. You make a phone call you've been dreading. You take a walk when your mind insists the day is already lost. These motions are like tiny fractures running through the spell, weakening the structure of the hesitation until one day you feel it give beneath you, and you realize that you are no longer paused. One of the most liberating discoveries I've made is that hesitation can only survive in stillness. It thrives when you remain immobile, when you keep thinking without acting, when you let fear set the pace. But even one small motion disrupts its rhythm. Movement contradicts hesitation's premise. It proves that you are not trapped, and once you have evidence, physical evidence, that you can move, hesitation loses its authority. I wish I could promise that breaking the spell is permanent. It isn't. Hesitation returns whenever you approach a new threshold. It returns whenever you care deeply about something. It returns when the stakes feel high or the unknown feels wide. But each time you move anyway, you weaken its influence. You teach yourself that you can navigate uncertainty. You build a kind of internal muscle memory, a trust that grows not from confidence, but from experience. This is the part I hope you carry with you. You do not break the spell of hesitation by waiting for courage or clarity or readiness. You break it by moving while the spell is still active. You break it before the fog lifts. You break it while your hands are still trembling. The spell breaks because you break it. Unseen forces may have shaped your hesitation, but conscious, intentional motion reshapes everything that comes after, and once you take that first small step, the world tilts, barely, quietly, back toward possibility. From there, your life begins to move again. One breath, one gesture, one decision at a time. Chapter 8. Choosing One Thing When Everything Feels Urgent. Distinctly, there are days when every part of your life seems to call your name at once. The undone tasks, the ignored dreams, the messages unanswered, the responsibilities you meant to shoulder more gracefully, the quiet longings you've spent years trying not to hear. Suddenly they all rise to the surface, each insisting it deserves your immediate attention. It feels like standing at the center of a crowded room where everyone speaks at the same time, each voice layered over the next until the noise becomes paralyzing. You want to do everything, fix everything, start everything, and because you can't, you do nothing. Not out of apathy, but out of overwhelm. When everything feels urgent, motion becomes impossible. I know that feeling too well. For a long stretch of my life, urgency shaped the entire terrain of my days. I woke each morning with a heavy, breathless sense that I was catastrophically behind. Behind on my work, behind on my relationships, behind on the promises I'd made to myself. Even the dreams I cherish most began to feel like obligations because I'd postponed them for so long that beginning felt like a kind of emergency. I was drowning in tasks that were important, tasks that were trivial, tasks that mattered deeply, tasks that mattered not at all, but my mind made no distinction. Everything felt like it carried the same weight, the same demand, the same whisper of do it now or regret it forever. It was overwhelming not because the tasks themselves were impossible, but because urgency had collapsed them into a single undifferentiated mass. What I didn't understand then, and what took years to learn, is that urgency is often a symptom of disconnect. When your days aren't anchored to something grounded and real, everything floats upward with equal pressure. Without a clear sense of what truly matters, you respond to whatever yells the loudest. You spend your energy putting out psychological fires that exist only because you've never paused long enough to ask which flames require water, and which are nothing more than shadows on the wall. Choosing one thing and ignoring everything else, even temporarily, feels like an outrageous act when you're used to carrying the weight of many. Focusing on one thing feels indulgent when you've spent years believing you must attend to all things at once. But choosing one thing is not a luxury. It is an essential, life-subverving act. And it may be the only way to reclaim forward motion when overwhelm has quietly taken over. There was a moment years ago that crystallized this truth for me. I was sitting on my living room floor, surrounded by scattered notes, unfinished projects, half-formed ideas, deadlines I'd let slip. I remember staring at the mess, feeling my heartbeat accelerate, my breath shallow. Every task on the floor felt like it carried equal importance, equal urgency. I tried to choose one but couldn't. My mind bounced from one to the next like a frantic pinball, unable to land. In that moment, choosing anything felt like betraying everything else. Doing one thing meant not doing the others, and the guilt of that felt unbearable. But then, almost accidentally, my eye caught on a single small task. Something ridiculously simple. A page that needed rewriting. A page I'd avoided because it seemed too insignificant to matter among the bigger responsibilities. I don't know why I chose it, maybe because it didn't scare me, maybe because it was the only thing that didn't feel heavy, but I picked it up. I sat down, I worked on it, and when I finished, I felt something shift. Not in the page, but in me. That single action broke the trance of urgency. It reminded me that motion exists on the other side of choice. It taught me that overwhelm is not an indication that everything is equally important. It's an indication that your inner compass is clouded, not broken. And the simplest way to clear that cloud is to choose one thing and trust that everything else can wait, even if only for a short while. But choosing one thing requires honesty. You must acknowledge the truth that you cannot do everything at once, no matter how desperately you want to. You must acknowledge that urgency often disguises itself as importance, even when the thing pressuring you is no more than a loud thought. And you must acknowledge that your mind will rebel against focusing on one thing, because your fear insists that everything depends on your ability to juggle. Choosing one thing is the practice of relearning the difference between what is loud and what is meaningful. It's a strange kind of courage to quiet the chaos and whisper, "This. Just this," a courage that doesn't look bold from the outside but often feels radical on the inside. Sometimes the one thing you choose is the thing you've avoided the longest. Sometimes it's the thing you miss the most. Sometimes it's the thing that feels the smallest because doing something small feels less terrifying than attempting something enormous. And sometimes the one thing is the action that feels almost embarrassingly simple. Drink water, clean your desk, send a message, take a walk, make the appointment, open the file, breathe. These choices seem irrelevant in the face of everything demanding your attention. But small actions are often the only ones capable of cutting through the paralysis of too much. When everything feels urgent, your mind becomes a storm. But storms don't last. They lose power when you refuse to keep feeding them. One grounded action is often enough to stop the winds from spinning so violently. Most people I've met who feel overwhelmed believe the solution is to develop a better system, to organize more effectively, to create a stronger routine, to build a stricter structure. Those things can help, but systems don't fix overwhelm. Systems help you manage motion once motion exists, but only choice, small, simple, courageous choice, creates the initial path through chaos. It's important to understand that choosing one thing is not the same as abandoning the others. It's not a permanent rejection of your responsibilities or your dreams. It's a momentary reorientation, a way of reminding your mind and body that movement is still possible, that you do not need to solve everything to begin something. Choosing one thing is the antidote to the myth that life requires you to hold everything at once. I think of it like lifting a heavy object. If you try to lift it in its entirety, you strain and fail. But if you break it down, piece by piece, part by part, you discover that what once seemed impossible becomes manageable. You rebuild your confidence through the pieces, and eventually, the whole becomes less intimidating. Choosing one thing is how you break your life into pieces you can carry. There is a quiet power in that. A power that begins to rebuild trust in your own agency, a power that steadies the nervous system that has grown accustomed to living in a constant state of alarm, a power that turns overwhelm from a tidal wave into something you can wade through. But perhaps the most important truth is this: choosing one thing teaches you how to listen to yourself again. When you are overwhelmed, you lose contact with your own instincts. You listen only to the loudest internal alarms, not to the deeper knowing beneath them. But when you slow down enough to choose one thing, you reconnect with that knowing. It may be faint at first. It may speak in whispers rather than command, but it is there, and each time you honor it, it grows louder. Eventually, it becomes a compass again. So when everything feels urgent, when your mind insists that every direction is equally important, pause. Place a hand on the moment you are in. Then ask yourself, gently and honestly, if you could only do one thing today, one thing, what would it be? Let yourself hear the answer that rises, even if it surprises you, even if it scares you, even if it seems too small to matter. That answer is your way forward. Because your life does not open through urgency, it opens through focus. And focus begins with a single choice. Chapter 9. The Honest Work of Showing Up. Inevitably, there comes a point when all the thinking, planning, imagining, and preparing runs out of places to hide, and the only thing left is the unglamorous work of showing up. Not showing up as the ideal version of yourself you keep hoping will magically appear, polished and disciplined and unshakably motivated, but showing up exactly as you are. Tired, uncertain, resistant, hopeful, inconsistent, human. This kind of showing up isn't dramatic. No one applauds it. It doesn't make for a triumphant headline or a cinematic moment, but it's the quiet turning point of every real transformation, because nothing changes until you show up. The trouble is, showing up sounds simple, too simple almost. People tend to imagine action as something large and impressive, a sprint, a leap, a breakthrough. But when you strip away the narratives we've built around achievement, most progress is born from unremarkable, repetitive presence. The writer who sits down on the days they have nothing to say. The runner who laces their shoes even when their legs feel heavy. The friend who stays in the conversation instead of shutting down. The person who returns to their dream again and again, long after the initial spark has dimmed. This kind of showing up asks something more intimate than motivation. It asks for honesty. The honesty to admit that the hardest part is rarely the task itself. It's the moment right before the task, when your mind tries to convince you that avoiding the work will feel better than doing it. That tiny moment is where hesitation grows teeth, and that tiny moment is where most people retreat. I know that moment intimately. There were years when I lived inside it, hovering on the threshold of action, but never quite crossing it. I'd wake up with intentions that felt sincere, even noble. I'd tell myself that today would be different. Today I would sit down and begin. But when the moment arrived, when I actually had to choose between showing up and avoiding, I'd find myself quietly drifting toward distraction. I'd straighten the desk. I'd reorganize the bookshelf. I'd reply to emails that didn't matter, all the while convincing myself that I was preparing, that I'd start in just a minute. But minutes turned into afternoons, and afternoons turned into seasons, and I remained achingly still. What finally shifted things for me wasn't a burst of determination or some dramatic epiphany. It was a morning when I sat down in front of a blank page and, instead of negotiating with myself, simply stayed. I didn't feel ready. I didn't feel inspired. I didn't feel confident. But I felt present. And that presence, small and quiet as it was, became the start of a practice that would eventually teach me that showing up is not a feeling, it's a choice, made in the moment, without the need for permission or certainty. The honest work of showing up is uncomfortable because it exposes you, not to others necessarily, but to yourself. When you show up, you confront the truth of what you can actually do, who you currently are, what you're capable of in this exact moment, and that reality rarely aligns with the idealized version of yourself you carry in your mind. Avoidance protects the fantasy. Showing up shatters it. And because humans are allergic to disappointment, even self-inflicted disappointment, we'd often rather avoid than confront the gap between who we imagine ourselves to be and who we actually are right now. But here's the thing. The version of you that you're trying so hard to become cannot emerge unless you're willing to show up as the version you are right now. Real growth begins with honesty, not aspiration. And honesty often looks like acknowledging the mess, not pretending you're above it. One of the most liberating truths I've learned is that showing up imperfectly counts. In fact, it counts more than showing up flawlessly, because imperfect effort builds resilience. It teaches you that you can continue even when conditions aren't ideal, even when you're not at your best, even when the world isn't cheering. It teaches you that action is possible in the presence of doubt. It reinforces the truth that you are allowed to exist in motion, not just in imagined potential. People often believe that showing up requires motivation, but motivation is fickle, beautiful when it arrives, unreliable when you need it most. What you really need is a willingness to enter the moment before motivation appears, a willingness to begin with whatever energy you have, a willingness to be present without guarantees. Showing up is not an act of heroism, it's an act of alignment. When you show up, you say, "This matters to me." Not because I'm good at it, not because I'm certain it will work, not because others expect it of me, but because I have chosen it. That choice, repeated consistently, becomes the architecture of your life. I once watched a friend rebuild her entire sense of self through the simple act of showing up to a daily practice she'd avoided for years. It wasn't dramatic. She didn't make sweeping declarations or reinvent her entire life overnight. She just showed up, day after day, sometimes for 5 minutes, sometimes for an hour, sometimes reluctantly, sometimes eagerly. And somewhere along the way, the practice became not a task, but a refuge, a way of steadying herself in a world that felt increasingly chaotic. She told me once that showing up felt like returning home to the part of her she'd neglected but never lost. That stayed with me. Showing up is a returning to your own intention, your own desire, your own becoming. It's how you learn to trust yourself again after years of breaking promises to your own heart. There's a tenderness required here, a gentleness with yourself that might feel foreign at first. You may not show up beautifully. You may not show up consistently. You may falter, backtrack, disappear for a while. But the point is not perfection. The point is the returning, the willingness to come back and begin again even after days or weeks of silence. Each return strengthens something internal, a sense of inner reliability that cannot be cultivated through thought alone. Sometimes showing up simply means sitting in the chair. Sometimes it means opening the document. Sometimes it means making the call. Sometimes it means standing up straight. Sometimes it means breathing deeply before you speak. These gestures, tiny and ordinary, are the seeds of movement. They don't feel profound in real time, but they accumulate. They change you quietly, steadily, inevitably. And perhaps the most unexpected gift of showing up is this: it brings you back into relationship with your own life. When you avoid, you watch your life from the sidelines. When you show up, you re-enter it. You participate. You shape instead of drift. You move instead of wait. You may never feel fully ready. You may never feel fully brave. But readiness is not the requirement. Presence is. The honest work of showing up is the foundation beneath every dream, every shift, every healed wound, every new beginning. It is the work that no one sees, the work that no one applauds, the work that transforms you quietly from within. Show up to the moment before you feel like it. Show up to the task before you're good at it. Show up to your life before you've figured it out. That's where momentum begins. And momentum, slow, humble, imperfect momentum, is what carries you into the life you've been trying to reach. If these 9 chapters have been speaking to you, if they've nudged something awake, if they've made you see your hesitation differently, if they've given you even one moment of recognition, then I want you to know this: the journey doesn't end here. The rest of Start Today goes deeper. into momentum, into discipline, into self-trust, into the quiet courage of becoming someone who moves through their life with intention instead of fear. And those next 15 chapters, they're where the transformation really takes root. If you're ready for more, more clarity, more honesty, more forward motion, head to audiobooks.com. You can get the full ebook there and continue the path you've already started. Not someday, not when life feels less chaotic, now, while the part of you that's waking up is still listening. Visit audiobooksoffice.com and keep going. Your next chapter is waiting for you.